In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We explore the history of America, the history of language, and the history of an urban forest. From SDPB, today is Monday, August 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we begin with the trees. A new book explores the trees that have grown up with the state's largest city. We welcome Paul DeYoung and Mike Cooper. Then, state historian Ben Jones joins us. In 1976, he was an elementary school kid helping decide what to put in a time capsule. Now he's getting ready to open that time capsule while America plans for a 250th birthday. Plus, you hear her Sunday mornings on SDPB Playing with Words. Now, Martha Barnett has a new book. We'll talk with her about language and love. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If the trees around you were telling you a story, what would they say? That is a question Paul DeYoung sought to answer. He's the author of the book, If Our Trees Could Talk, Discovering the Urban Forest of Sioux Falls. Paul DeYoung is a former co-owner of Landscape Garden Centers. He wrote the book with Mike Cooper, who is a retired city planning director. Cooper is now executive director of the Mary Jo Wegner Arboretum near Sioux Falls. Paul DeYoung and Mike Cooper join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. This is a beautiful coffee table book in full color with gorgeous photography by Paul Schiller, and it is called If Our Trees Could Talk, Discovering the Urban Forest of Sioux Falls. And most people don't put urban and forest together, Paul. Tell me a little bit about the background of the book.
Well, that's an excellent question. For 12 years, I did a radio show on KSO on Saturday mornings, so it was quite a commitment. But several times and many times in my career, I said, picture this city with no trees. It'd be a pretty drab environment. And all the benefits of the trees that go unnoticed would definitely be noticed. And so then I had this idea that it started out as a calendar form, and Mike pressed and said, we can do better than that. So it started out as a calendar with 12 pictures of seasonal beauty, and then transitioned into this book. So it kind of, and Paul Schiller came on board, so we had some great photography and Mike's urban forest knowledge. And Mike and I spent a lot of time driving around. We had close to many accidents. We never actually hit anybody because we were busy looking at trees. So we'd get distracted driving. Isn't that right, Mike?
Yeah. So the story really continues on about how this came together, that Paul and I had known each other for quite a while when he was at Landscape Garden Centers and I was with City Planning. And we had talked to each other on occasion about what was going on around the place that they used to have on Minnesota Avenue. So we got to know each other pretty well. And then when I retired from the City Planning, I worked out at Landscape Garden Centers for about a year and a half, trying to get different property owners interested in dealing with the emerald ash borer that was going to start invading our city. So we've known each other a long time. And then through the Arboretum, Paul has served on the Arboretum Board of Directors. And then I came on board as now the executive director. So anyway, when we started talking about this pretty seriously, the idea came about, well, let's look at different neighborhoods and let's put some historical context in it with like the Cathedral North End in the 1880s and looking at different decades of neighborhood development.
Sure.
And some of the trees and stories that came about. So that's kind of how it evolved in terms of the format. But we did spend a lot of time driving around, and this guy, I'm pointing to Paul, I think knows more about trees than anybody I've ever come across. So we had a really great time going around to the different neighborhoods to see what we should highlight and what kind of stories we could put into the book about those trees.
So, Paul, you grew up farming, right?
I grew up on a farm. My dad was kind of a tree buff, so we did a lot of shelter belt planting. My dad was a real outdoorsman. In the early 80s, I started working, which was at Lakeland Nursery, which is now Landscape Garden Center. I started on the end of the shovel and ended up being in an co-ownership position for many years. So it was kind of a love affair. I guess I never really got a real job. I was going to work there a short time till I could get a real job. And I stayed in the deluxe motel in the meantime. But getting back to the tree book, so I've always been a tree lover, and I probably had a little more experience with trees than somebody just starting out in the garden center business. But getting back to the title of the book, If Our Trees Could Talk, it came from, there's a catalpa tree. It's in a back alley near the Pettigrew Museum, and it's just gigantic. Mm. And it was a horse stable, so it was in the 1800s, and they converted it into a garage, and that tree stood all those seasons there. And I made mention if that tree could talk, and I believe it was Heather Kittleson. She's also on the Arboretum board. She said, that's it, that's a name for the book. So that's how that came to be, is my statement, If That Tree Could Talk. And I thought it was kind of a clever name. I was just going to call it Exploring the Urban Forest, which would have been fine, but I thought this added a little flair and creativity to it.
Yeah, because so much has happened, Mike, under those trees.
Yeah, you think
the
about
the stories they could tell.
And we were looking specifically not only to highlight some unique trees within the neighborhoods, but also maybe those that the public would really be interested in kind of seeing them and knowing how they got there and what brought them to that area. And then we were so fortunate as we got into this of looking at the third leg of the stool, which is the photography. And we looked at some other options, but then I'm not sure how Paul Schiller, maybe you're the one that got him to participate, but he came forward and said, yeah, I'll help you guys with this book. And it took a little longer just because we spent a lot of time not only identifying the locations and the type of trees, but we wanted to get some at different seasons of the year too. I tell people that this book took a long time because Paul DeYoung kept saying, well, there's another tree out there we should go look at. There's another tree that I want to look at. So,
and there's still a few more trees. Like
there's
that.
Still more out there. Yes,
so
there are.
So they cut me off.
We have to go to press. I was moved by a photo that Paul Schiller took of Sherman Park. And with the title, If Our Trees Could Talk, imagining the kids who have played there and how lucky those trees are in the sense that their particular position in the city is really surrounded by joy.
Well, just another sidebar, a person that has been called the father of our parks is E.A. Sherman.
Yeah.
And he's the namesake of Sherman Park. And when he came on board getting the park system started, he was a huge tree lover, and so he wanted to plant trees everywhere. A lot of elm trees, a lot of honey locust trees, oak trees, those kind of things. So you can still see some of those in Sherman Park, probably from back in those early days.
So, Paul, how well, when you started this book, did you already know the trees of the city, and how much of it was you went on a treasure hunt to find something specific?
Most of them I had seen in my career, and I had just never written down the address, and so we had to go log the addresses. Most of them can be seen from the city right away, so there's not many that are off limits. So I had a general idea, and then we discovered a few more, because it's just a treasure in this city. Like we talk, I live at Touchmark, and I no longer drive, so I take my scooter to McKinnon Park about every day, and that's just, Helen McKinnon donated that land with the intentions where mothers could spend time with their children, and I go there on a spring or summer day, and it's just filled with kids and mothers pushing their strollers, and fathers, but her dream turned into a reality. And there's some very old trees in that park. So but we have to keep restoring. As we know, the weather's been kind of blustery this week, so some trees were damaged. So we got to continually restore the urban forest, continue to plant, and educate the next generation.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think about McKinnon Park, and historically we've gone through the Dutch elm disease and the emerald ash borer now. So, you know, over decades, these trees have had a lot of environmental weather issues that they've had to deal with. And so the ones that are still around from years ago are pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. You mentioned your father. I think of my grandmother who lived in a small town in southwest Minnesota, and she lost a tree during a storm, big old tree. I'm sorry, I don't know what kind of tree it was. But then she replanted one shortly thereafter. She was 93 when she planted that tree. And I remember thinking, well, there's a lesson for you because she's not going to see this tree become big and expansive, but she was forward thinking. Yep. So our elders understood that, Mike, is what I'm getting at. Yep. But the education is what Paul is saying. That's not necessarily going to be passed down unless sometimes you tell people and you plan for it.
Well, you think about even now, if somebody wants to remember a loved one or an acquaintance that has passed on, a lot of the times they'll say, let's plant a tree somewhere. So that, you know, that legacy goes on forever. But again, the neighborhoods are so important because when the early development of Sioux Falls started, they brought in trees. They found trees down by the river, saplings. They had imported trees. So trees have always been an important part of the population of Sioux Falls. And one of the concerns that we discovered as we drove around, as you get farther out into the newer neighborhoods on the edge of the city limits, you see fewer and fewer trees. And so is that because people are not interested in planting trees or they don't know what they should plant? Sometimes the soil conditions are not really great. But again, I thought, or we thought, that with this book, we could really get the word out better, show kids, adults, everybody, here's examples of trees that have thrived in the city, and here's ideas of trees that you could put in your particular neighborhood. So that's kind of another educational aspect of what we wanted to do.
Paul, tell me how you make some of those decisions about planting trees.
Well, just from years of experience, and the first thing you got to do is diversify, because we learn slowly. Because first there is the elm tree, now the ash tree. Now we're starting to overplant Freemani or maple species, like particularly autumn blaze maple. Now we're starting to see, 20, 30 years after you start planting that species, we're starting to see some issues with that. So diversify what your neighbor has, plant something differently. Don't plant all it's nice sometimes to plant them all in one row, the same species. It can look kind of sharp, but that's one of the worst things you can do, because if a disease or pest moves through that, you're going to lose all your trees.
You said before, look to the left, look to the right, and plant something different of your neighbors.
Correct, whereas otherwise a lot of people, the neighborhood's filled with one species of trees because they happen to like the neighbor's tree.
Right, that's pretty. I want one of those. Yeah. How do you know, does being native to this area matter? Is the definition of that expanded over time as far as what can be hardy and what can survive?
A lot of it spurs down the soil. Like you get in the Riverview Heights area, which is right in Kiwanis area, and like the VA and McKinnon Park area, there's a lot of species that will not do well on the edges of town. That'll do well in undisturbed soils and more protection.
Yeah.
So you really got to explore what species work, because we grew most of our own trees. So we could tell if we planted 20 of this variety and 19 of them survived, that's a pretty good success rate. So you can kind of balance your decision based on that. So that's why we got to continue to educate. And Mike and his staff at the Arboretum do a lot of ongoing education with that. And we're tossing around maybe doing a junior version of this book for young kids, where they can earn an urban forest diploma where they identify certain trees, where they get a list to get them incur- that way they can encourage their parents and gets their parents involved too.
Yeah. How are you telling how old a tree is in the city? If you, do you measure that? Do you, how do you know how long that tree has been around?
I think Mike can elaborate on that. Mike was in urban planning, but a lot of it comes down, you can guesstimate. You can core drill them, but that gets kind of expensive and it doesn't sound real pleasant for the tree. But we go by, like the cathedral area, when that area was built, it was in the late 1800s, where McKinnon Park was a little bit later. Riverview Heights was a little bit later. So you go by the when the house and development was built.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's typically, you're right in there within 10 years of what, how old a tree is.
Yeah, you can kind of gauge it by the age of the neighborhood. And
okay, so when, I live in Hilltop. My house was built in 1958.
Yeah,
I have
I was
two
just
enormous
say, though,
linden trees.
The late 50s, early 60s, yes.
So does that, was that, so then probably those linden trees were built at the, or were planted at the same time?
Yep, and probably when the, they were planted, they might have been a year or two old from
okay.
the nursery.
Okay.
So yeah, you can use it. You can gauge it that way. So you didn't have to cut it down and count the rings.
No, I don't want to do that. Yeah. And I was sitting by my screen door during the storm and not taking it as seriously as I should have been taking it because I had the window open. I was just very relaxed. And then that tree started moving, and I was like, this is a basement moment, just in case. And the tree stood, but I did go into my basement just in case.
Yes.
Because to your you know, comment about the, that was a pretty intense storm.
Exactly. And we've had a lot of those in recent years, unfortunately.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of your favorites. They're, first of all, the photography. Paul Schiller, if you're listening, I mean, thank you.
He's the best. He is
just,
the best.
It's just top-notch photography that just makes me love all these trees. Do you have favorite trees? Paul, we'll start with you.
Every tree in there is his favorite, but I'll let you elaborate on maybe one or two that stand out.
A mature oak tree and the catalpa tree by the Pettigrew Museum is probably the one that stands out the most for me. And the, there's some weeping Norway spruce that are in the Riverview Heights area that are just stunning. They're not really a weep. They're kind of a drooping branch, but they're really striking. And I always say if a tree has a little character, if it's crooked or has a crook in it, everybody starts out, they want the straightest tree. I say you're not planting a telephone pole. You got to have some character in there too.
Nice, yeah.
So there's several in there that are outstanding.
I think part of the part of the older area maybe is a little bit more impressive just because they've been there longer, but kind of going back to the McKinnon Park All Saints area that you patrol on a regular basis, you know, just within McKinnon Park, you've got some pretty spectacular trees. And I think, you know, the oaks, the maples, some of those more legacy type trees.
Yeah.
But there's another one that we spent a lot of time looking at 57th in Minnesota, a big old cottonwood. Talk about that one, maybe.
Yes, that's at an estate there. There's several houses that were built on that side, the west side of the road in the early 1900s. And there's a large cottonwood tree on that property. And I was talking to the homeowner, and she had photographs from when that house was being built. It was in 1914. And lo and behold, that cottonwood tree was in the background. And it wasn't just a sapling then, so that tree had been around for...
Yeah.
Over 100 years.
Wow.
But the one thing with cotton was initially they grow fast. So quite often when I was in the garden center business, I'd hear, I want a really fast growing tree, but they're not a legacy tree. They're the ones that are going to sway back and forth and break in the wind, where some of these legacy trees like bur oak and hard maple and something that grows slower is more sturdy.
Okay,
and
sure.
Then people probably think about the big shade trees are pretty spectacular. But as we looked around, we also included some smaller ornamental trees that are pretty spectacular, Paul, as far as their flowering. And we wanted to make sure that the photography reflected the blooming period of some of those ornamental trees.
Yeah,
because red bud trees, flowering crab, flowering pear, they're you get your spring floral from that. And later on in early June, you get the hawthorn tree and the Japanese lilac tree. And then the last one to bloom for the season is the catalpa tree. And a lot of times that used to be called the Father's Day tree because that's usually the week it blooms. And lo and behold, the last 3 years I've been monitoring it. About 2-3 days before Father's Day, they start blooming.
Yeah.
And the weather's can be entirely different, but it's pretty consistent.
The different seasons, which again we try to reflect somewhat in the book, is it's not just a summertime thing or spring, but fall and winter can be pretty spectacular around here too. And we do have some interesting fall color around here.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't last very long, but it depends on the temperature and the sunlight and all those kind of factors.
There's a spectacular larch tree in McKinnon Park, and they look like a conifer or evergreen, so to say. But they turn a real bright yellow or golden color in the fall, and they drop their needles. So I've heard on occasion people have cut those down because they thought they died, but they're actually lose their foliage and comes back the next spring. So.
Oh. All right.
And then the winter, they're almost a spooky, mysterious look. They got these little catkins or seeds on them. But beauty's in the eye of the beholder. There's beauty and ruggedness, too.
That's Paul DeYoung and Mike Cooper. Their book is called If Our Trees Could Talk, Discovering the Urban Forest of Sioux Falls. It is a coffee table book with photography by Paul Schiller. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. 2026 marks the United States' 250th anniversary. South Dakota is getting ready to celebrate. Ben Jones is an American historian, our state historian, and director of the South Dakota State Historical Society. I sat down with him to hear how the plans are coming together.
We're sticking with the term America 250.
America 250.
Right. If you wanted to be like, I remember the bicentennial.
Mm-hmm.
I was 9 in 1976 when we celebrated the bicentennial. And so if we're going to keep up with the Latin terms, we would call it the semi-quincentennial.
Mm-hmm.
Centennial being 100, quin meaning 5, semi meaning half of 500. But if you want to avoid all that, just keep it simple. We say America 250.
What do you remember about 1976 when you were 9?
Yeah.
I was younger, but I had a little flag.
Okay.
I remember a little flag that I waved.
Very good.
Yeah.
I remember I was a student at Mark Twain Elementary, which is no longer there,
and
we had a time capsule.
Nice.
And we buried the time capsule for 50 years. So guess what's going to happen on May 20th of 2026?
You're going to find it.
59-year-old Ben Jones is going to be at the former Mark Twain Elementary opening up that time capsule.
What is that now? Sonia Sotomayor?
It is, no.
No.
Another author's name. Susan B. Anthony.
Susan B. Anthony. Okay.
Yeah, she's an author of other things, not novels. yes, Susan B. Anthony, grade school, the principal there several months ago confirmed that, yep, the time capsule is still on track to be
opened. Do you remember what's in it?
I remember one thing.
Are you releasing that information?
I am. A Fonzie jacket.
Oh.
Yes. I the thing
was that
filled.
Your idea? Did
I
they
don't
ask
know.
The students?
I can imagine that they probably did.
In 1976, they ask the kids of Mark Twain Elementary what to put in the time capsule, and those kids voted on a Fonzie jacket, among other things.
That's
my guess.
Yeah, I don't recall the details of all of that. I just remember the glee that we had sitting out in the park. It was a lovely day in May and a picnic lunch. And I've since, now there's a Facebook page for it, as you might imagine. And a former teacher, I guess, whose name I don't recall her. She must have been fifth grade or so, but started this Facebook page. So that's where I've seen a picture of the events of that day.
Fonzie, in case you don't know, because you were not 9 years old in 1976, is a character from a television show played by the great Henry Winkler.
Right.
And he was very cool.
Yes, very cool.
What's happening now for planning for America at 250?
So there's planning at the many different levels. At the national level, Congress in 2016 set up the America 250 Commission. They have been talking about this and planning a number of things, one of which is a time capsule at the national scale. So We heard last week that the time capsule will be buried in Philadelphia. It's in the federal statute that some parameters of that time capsule, and it's going to reflect national and state events for the semi-quincentennial, and will be opened in 2276. So it will be there for 250 years. It is not much bigger than a shoebox, so they've been working with the tech folks at National Institute of Standards, who come up with all kinds of technical ideas about things and how they're going to represent that. They've not been too well. The details have yet to be done, but they've picked a site at Philadelphia, right across the street from Independence Hall.
Okay.
So there'll be an event there, probably early July of next year.
Will there be opening of time capsules across America, do you think, if Mark Twain Elementary in South Dakota buried one?
Right.
Rural communities across South Dakota surely commemorated 1976 in similar ways.
They did. And
tell us your stories in the moment at FDPB.
That's right.
Yeah.
And people will be very interested. So if your communities and other schools buried time capsules, it might be time to dig those things up and pop them open.
There's a whole lesson
right.
plan. Okay.
Exactly.
So
one thing about time capsules, too, and I think what I've reflected on is the first time that I thought, as a 9-year-old kid, wow, this someday will be history. And how, I don't know, I wouldn't necessarily credit that for me becoming a historian, but it was, I do remember thinking, someday this will be historic.
Made that connection at 9.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's good. So listeners are out there thinking about what we can do, particularly with kids, young kids, even high schoolers, I think, would get a kick out of a time capsule.
Yeah. I'm thinking about making decisions about what goes in the sense that for those kids, the culture was important. The things that were part
right.
of American culture
right.
wasn't just historically, you know, who's in charge of this, what is happening politically. Mm-hmm. It was also like, hey, this is what America is like right now culturally, and it happened to be something that was really popular at the time on television.
Exactly. You want to choose things that are meaningful to those who are putting them in there and kind of send that to the future.
Yeah.
In a message of these are the things that meant things to us at the time.
Yeah.
And we might chuckle about Fonzie's jacket now, but
it's not the only thing in there. There's more in
that
we're going to find out.
I just don't
that
remember
that.
What they were.
Yeah. 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 Oh, how interesting.
Now, that's what I remember. Who knows if my 9-year-old memory is accurate at all, but I could be confusing things.
Maybe you wanted Fonzie jacket.
Maybe
to
I did. Maybe I lobbied for a Fonzie jacket and lost the argument. I don't know.
All right. What else is happening at the national level?
So, well, a lot of things. They just rolled out last week, too, an oral history program, which they're calling Telling America's Story.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to nominate somebody to be part of this national oral history program, you can go on the website, nominate somebody's name. They've collaborated with Walmart and will be taking this Airstream trailer, camper, to Walmart parking lots around the country to gather those interviews, and those interviews will ultimately be in the National Archives.
Okay. What else? National stuff.
The national level, too, they are working on what they call various tentpole things to celebrate America. And another thing that's kind of rolled out in 2 iterations so far, and I think there'll be 3, maybe 4 more, is America's Field Trip.
Mm.
So this is grades 3 through 12, can compete in an essay contest, and the winners around the nation get to go kind of a behind-the-scenes tour at a national museum or national park. So this last summer, that was the second round of those competitions, and 6 kids chose Mount Rushmore. Others went to the Smithsonian. NASA was pretty popular. And the National Archives and so forth. There were various things in the National Mall. Grand Canyon is on that list, too. So you can check all that out at America250.org and see the America's Field Trip and get your kids ready for the next iteration that will come down the pike.
What is happening in South Dakota? Again, this is next. This is 2026, July 4th, is the actual 250th, right?
Yep.
So we're planning.
Yep.
But some things have started.
Yes.
Yeah. What's happening in South Dakota?
We are opening our events at the State Fair this year, so we're going to roll that out. The fair has long done a program they call the State's Largest Classroom, And so that is occurring on the 28th, which is the Thursday of the fair week, August 28th. And we're going to have an event there at the Freedom Stage and have kids come and declare their own independence. So we've got declarations of independence that are blank and that they can sign and be a part of that. So we'll have the kids come up with a feather pen and sign their Declaration of Independence.
From what?
From... From King George.
Okay.
We're sticking to that.
Okay.
I don't want to cause any problems between kids and their parents, but, but we'll stick with that. I think those ideas in the Declaration of Independence and those that have been mulled around and expanded upon and fought for ever since, I think is a good thing to introduce the kids of all ages to.
Yeah. For people who are thinking about how this relates to South Dakota, because we weren't a state, then, certainly, what are some of the connections to America's 250th and South Dakota history? What are some of the intersection points?
Yeah. If you read in our Constitution, it says in our state Constitution, well, in federal law, that as territories become states, so in the 1880s when South Dakota was desiring statehood from 1883 till 1889, the federal law and the Constitution requires that a Republican form of government, small r, be set up to become a state. And so the state had guidance in the Constitution about how it was to be modeled. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Constitution is the framework for enshrining the ideals of the Declaration. So I guess there's the Declaration, the federal Constitution, and the state's Constitution falls within that framework. There's also certainly interesting things to note about who was living here in the 1770s. And we hope at the Historical Society to be rolling out some things about some programming. We're getting our act together on that. But we've certainly done a lot of other stuff in the past about late 18th century history in the region. Mm-hmm. And so we hope
A lot of tribal history then? Is that what you mean?
Yes. And some of the, it would be certainly in 1776, it would be nearly all tribal history. And there was a few trappers around here. The Verendrye brothers were up and down the Missouri in the 1740s and so forth. So there was just a hint of some of that, but certainly most of it would be tribal history.
Hmm. Yes. How are municipalities and towns and cities across South Dakota starting to figure out how they might plan and celebrate or inquire or have conversations around, you know, everything from the anniversary itself to the essential ideals of the Declaration of Independence?
We are still, I think, with communities and with tribes in the getting out the word phase. We're still in an awareness phase for many folks.
Yeah.
So with city councils around the state and with tribal councils around the state, we've been communicating to them, say, this is coming, you know, think about how you want to do it. What are the activities you want to do? And so we've provided kind of a handbook on how to do a city proclamation, what that language might look like. It's very kind of preliminary, so forth. So it would be great if citizens and communities around the state would go to their city councils and say, what's your plan? And I think that will begin to happen as we get more and more of the population kind of aware.
Yeah. What else are you excited about? I saw the Game Fish and Parks and the State Library had already kind of launched.
Mm-hmm.
So in the there's something for everybody. I was like, ooh, State Library, reading challenge.
Right.
I'm in.
Yeah. Right. There's a reading challenge that they've got. You can go on our webpage, americas250thsd.gov, and you can go on there and look at the programs we have. We wanted to, with the state parks, I'll just mention them at first, because they rolled out the Walk 250 last summer.
Yeah.
We wanted to give people an appreciation for how many 250 is. It's a big deal to be a republic for 250 years or to be constituted as an independent nation for 250 years and to the Declaration of Independence to celebrate that. And so we thought physically walking, running, biking 250 miles would be a good way to appreciate the number 250. So people have signed up, and some folks have already accomplished 250 miles. Not me, but others have. And the Game Fish and Parks is kind of running that. So if you go on the website, it'll take you to their link, and you can go in and sign up for some prizes, water bottles and, you know, de minimis kind of things like that. But that's a good way to do that. And then the State Library just a few months ago launched the reading program, and there's a certain number of points that people can get for the types of books they read, and it's, essentially it's 1,776 minutes, which comes out to about 30 hours. So it's not a ton of reading, but maybe to me it doesn't sound like a ton of reading. Others might think.
But
think
walking it, 250 miles seems like a little bit like of a challenge. Right. Yeah, so something for everybody.
Something for everybody.
What else do you want to cover today from an event standpoint?
Well, July 3rd of 2026, of course, there'll be fireworks at Mount Rushmore. So that'll be kind of the state's marquee event, and we certainly hope to have a lot of visitors with that. Preceding that, tourism has already, the Department of Tourism has created a passport program. So if you wanted to link the historic locations around the state, state museums and so forth, the tourism already has an app for that on their passport app. You can go and see, and it'll kind of help you design your trip or your family vacation or your weekend getaway around the state to the, that, so you can look at the passport program.
Yeah.
And we certainly hope that there'll be more. The air show, which will happen in Sioux Falls 2 weeks after July 4th of next year, they're a partner, and they plan on some having some semi-quincentennial events.
Mm-hmm.
And the battleship here in Sioux Falls, they're a partner, and they plan on having some events too. So I think a lot of local museums, Deadwood, will be doing things. They're hitting their 150th as a community. So 150 and 250 is what they're calling their stuff. So
start thinking about what you're going to do and start paying attention to what's happening in your community. You said it's a big deal to be a republic for 250 years. I don't want to get you in trouble, but in what areas is that republic being tested?
Well, Americans have argued since the very beginning of what it is to be American. So I think we have always tested ourselves. It's not unusual to be, for there to be bad news in the newspaper, for people to be upset about a wide variety of things, and that's as old as the republic. I think the fact that it has withstood all of that and has adapted, changed, overcome, but still kept the Declaration as its guide star is something to be proud of. And I think that is the unifying thing that can, that has always in the past kept us together, brought us together. When people argue about things, they tend to go back to that. They might be certainly quoting things from the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, but the, those...
We the people.
We the people.
We go back to that.
Yeah, we always go back to the Declaration. As John, I think it was John Adams, who, or no, Abraham Lincoln, said that the Constitution is the silver frame around the golden apple of the Declaration. And so Martin Luther King, whomever you might be, American Indian Movement, whoever it might be, always has used the Declaration as a guiding star. And so certainly the States Commission and the American Commission, one of our goals is to educate, well, three of our goals is to educate, engage, and unite the American people and South Dakotans around that, and that Declaration of Independence has long served to be a unifying goal.
That's Ben Jones, state historian and director of the South Dakota State Historical Society. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A faithful band of listeners tunes in to SDPB Radio Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. Central, 8 Mountain, to the show Away with Words. It's hosted by Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett. Each week is a smart and funny exploration of language and culture and history. And now Martha Barnett has a new book. I spoke with her about Friends with Words, Adventures in Language Land. This book, Friends with Words, has been such a comfort to me. I have laughed. I have spent many hours with it already. I have marked pages. So thank you for the book, first of all, coming at a really interesting time. That's what your show is like, though, too, that no matter what's happening, you get to gather together with a community. Tell me a little bit about how you have created this community of people who love language.
Well, I do think that our show is a little oasis of calm and curiosity and respecting people's intelligence and civil conversation. And And it's a place to, you know, let your curiosity run wild. I think when I started doing the show, which was 20 years ago, I ran into people who were like, well, why would I want to listen to a show about language, or what is there to talk about? And the fact is that after 20 years, we have not run out of things to talk about, because people are forever calling us with questions about language, whether it's a word or phrase that they wonder about its origin, or, you know, their grandfather used to say this weird expression and they don't know if it's his expression or if other people use it, or maybe they grew up in one part of the country and they went to another part of the country and used an expression that they thought everybody knew, and people there just looked at them like they had two heads. And so there's so much to talk about when it comes to language, and we like to say on the show that correcting other people's grammar is kind of the least interesting thing about it.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you have a pivot, I have a pivot. Many people who are into language and grammar have a moment where they shift from "that's wrong" to "that's wonderful." What was yours?
Well, I would say that at least once a month still, we get calls and emails from people who say, I got a new coworker and they use this expression, needs washed, you know, the car needs washed, or the baby needs picked up. And they wonder if that's grammatically correct. And, you know, they're poised to criticize this person. But the fact is that needs washed is a construction that you'll hear particularly in eastern Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Indiana. And it reflects Scots-Irish migration patterns, because in Scotland and Ireland, you'll hear this kind of construction. So it's a feature of dialect. And when I realized that, I found that really thrilling, you know, that we have these linguistic fossils that we carry around with us.
Yeah. One of the things I love on this show, and I'm sure you've experienced it as well, as the number of Lakota guests or Dakota guests we have. Mm-hmm. And we just had some artists, and the word they were talking about was Ikche, where they had done an entire exhibit on the Lakota notion of Ikche, which roughly means like ordinariness, humility, like being ordinary. And the moment I heard it, because the exhibit is called Ordinary Presence and it was Ikche, I was like, I want to know everything about that word. I want to go to the exhibit. So languages that are not of English origin from Western Europe also intersect in America in all these really exciting ways.
Oh, yeah. And I'm fascinated to learn this word. How do you spell it?
I-K-C-E. And then there's diacritical marks as well, because it's Lakota.
Oh, that's fascinating. I want to dig into that.
That's, we're sending our questions in. But like to your point about the pet peeves, I remember having a boss who said irregardless all the time, and it drove me crazy back in the olden days of before I had seen the light. And so explain this difference between like the prescriptive and descriptive way, because I was like, irregardless is not a word. Like, just stop saying it. You're the boss. And now it kind of a short period of time later is a word. And that's how fast it happens today.
Yes. And you'll hear people say it's not in the dictionary. Well, it is in the dictionary. Yeah. And Corey Stamper, a lexicographer who used to work at Merriam-Webster, has a wonderful book called Word by Word, where she explains that she did a deep dive into the word irregardless, and it actually has some shades of meaning that people don't realize. It's some emphasis that people don't realize. And that was a mind-blowing thing for me to learn, because I'm an English teacher's kid, and I was definitely told not to use that word, and I still have a little bit of trouble saying it. But that approach to language, to get back to your question, prescriptive grammar is, or prescriptive thinking about language has to do with prescribing how people should talk. And a lot of people want dictionaries to be prescriptive. You know, they want it to be like the social register rather than the phone book. But the fact is that the dictionaries are just a record of the way people talk. And a lot of people use that term. And when enough people start to use a term like that, it becomes part of the language, whether you like it or not.
Tell us a little bit about, we're talking about connection, and for you, connection with the listeners also turned into love. And I just love this story that, you know, she comes to an event and she says, "Hi, I've actually sent you a question before." Tell us a little bit about how you met your wife.
Well, we actually had a call on the show from her 6 years before Bonnie and I ever met. And to be honest, I thought it was kind of a boring call. She's from New York, and her question was about the difference between the words nice and kind, because she said, you know, I think of myself as a kind person. I don't necessarily think of myself as a nice person. She said nice tends to be more performative, and being kind comes from within. It comes from compassion and care. And so she wanted to tease out the differences between those two words. And you know, I mean, I just didn't find it all that interesting. I wanted to talk about the etymology of nice, which is really interesting because it goes back to a Latin word, nescius, which actually means not knowing. The S-C-I in nescius is related to the word science. And so early on, the earliest meaning of the word nice was somebody who wasn't that knowledgeable. And then the meaning of the word morphed over time, as often happens with language. Anyway, I wanted to get into all that, and she and my co-host didn't. And so I thought it was kind of a boring call. But then a few years later, I had been lonely for quite some time, and I'd done all the dating apps and just hadn't had any success. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I can put it out there to the universe on the airwaves. And I grabbed the opportunity when a listener called to talk about the fact that he didn't like the word ex, E-X. Mm-hmm. He had a really good relationship with his ex-wife, and he wanted a better word that didn't sound so harsh. And so I jumped on that, and I said, oh, yes, I understand what you mean. My ex and I, blah, blah, she and my ex and I, her, you know, and I was just hoping that somebody keyed in to the pronouns I was using. Yeah. And sure enough, this woman who had called us about nice and kind heard that, and a light bulb went on. And not long after, we had a trivia night here in San Diego to raise money for the radio show. And she showed up. And I saw her from across the room, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the evening, she put a piece of paper in my hand and said, it was nice to meet you. And it was the one time ever when I was hoping that it wasn't a check for our little nonprofit that produces and distributes the show. And I was just really hoping it was not a check. And it turned out to be her name and phone number. And we were married 2 years later.
I love that. That's my favorite part in the book, is you're like, I hope it's not a check. I hope it's not a check.
The one time ever. Yeah.
That's Martha Barnett of Away With Words. You can listen on SDPB Radio Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. Central, 8 Mountain, or download the podcast. Barnett's latest book is called Friends With Words, Adventures in Language Land. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Before we close, the In the Moment team sends out a special hello to loyal listener Bryce Vogel. Thank you, Bryce, for your devotion to all things SDPB. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.